No niin, tervetuloa tänne neuvottelijakanavalle. Oh, this is an English episode, so this is a negotiator episode. And we have a Korkia here. I have a Christina Sweet, country manager for Canada and head of sustainability.
Yes, sir.
And then we have James Spooner, the head of structuring and M&A.
Hi there.
And James, you actually flew here from my old hometown, London. But Christina, you actually live in Helsinki, or in the greater Helsinki, at least. Is that right?
I do. I live in Kirkkonummi.
Ah, fantastic. But are you Alberta born?
I'm Alberta born, Canadian raised.
If you had to compare Alberta to town in Finland, what would that be?
It would be close to central Finland.
Yeah, and then you had something in common with the president's wife, who you were working in Kone in Brussels. But did you come across with Susanna Ines Stubb?
I worked with her alongside of her in another post, but no, we were in Kone at different periods of time. I worked there many, many years ago.
Yeah, I'm an expat myself, so it's always fascinating how we guys kind of live in these different countries. But well done coming here in Finland and working in a value-added job at Korkia. And Korkia has been a guest in this renewable fund business a couple of times before. And now this is to show that you truly are an international company. So you have, eight countries which work in Matrix?
Yeah, so we're active in 9 countries, so very global in our footprint. We've got 17 gigawatts of renewable energy assets under development, solar, wind, and batteries.
And you, James, is a kind of a recent addition, so you have a bit of a Goldman Sachs background, and we're doing structuring for Korkia projects, but now your cooperation got so deep that they acquired your business. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So my background's in finance. I did 10 years at Goldman Sachs, straight out of school. So 10 years on the trading floor, a good training place, I guess. When I left, actually, my boss said that you haven't finished your training yet. And I had different views. And after that, set up a corporate finance advisory firm focused on the energy transition. And was lucky enough to bump into Korkia early in our journey. We did a number of a very many number of our deals together, found a common attitude, I think, to doing transactions and a vision for the energy transition industry. And ultimately that ended with both of our teams growing and then merging last year. So now very happy to be part of Korkia and the executive team and the next phase of the journey.
Yeah. Did Goldman still work at the City Fleet Street? I was in One Cabot Square in Canary Wharf with Credit Suisse. So.
I worked on Fleet Street. They, just as I left, actually, they moved to a bigger, better, newer building just around the corner on Holborn. But yeah, still in Fleet Street. And I must say, I always liked the fact that we were not in Canary Wharf.
Yeah, that sucked.
And also not even in the city. We were kind of on the, further west than the city. So I always liked the location. And near to St. Paul's as well, which is a nice place to go and sit for lunch.
Yeah, London times. We can come back to that. Christina, I mean, so you're in charge of the Canada business, and we discussed that there's some similarities to Finland. It's kind of a big, sparsely populated countries and lots of trees. And then it's actually surprisingly cold climate is quite suitable for solar panels. So people think that you need to be in a desert to get the solar power, but actually the clean, fresh northern air is actually pretty good for solar business. Could you talk a little bit about how this energy production forms is renewable kind of stuck together with the traditional business of a country like Canada?
Well, sure, I can try and do my best. So I'm from Alberta, and Alberta is a sort of an energy juggernaut. It's got a long history in oil and gas. And so it means that most Albertans, actually just over 10% of Albertans, work in the oil and gas industry. So it's sort of the bread and butter. Energy is the bread and butter for a lot of Albertans. I think one of the things that Alberta has been doing really well is recognizing that it can continue to be an energy juggernaut outside of traditional fossil fuels. And so Alberta itself is leading Canada's green energy transition, substantially so. It happens to be one of the only private energy markets as well in Canada. So it's really positioned well for energy transition. But one of the blessings, additional blessings of Alberta, it's sunny Alberta, and it's something like 250 plus sun days per year. So even though we do get, you know, substantially cold days, there's a lot of sun that comes, a lot of wind as well, a lot of sun that comes, which means that the economics and the blessings of solar can happen even in a cold province like Alberta.
Yeah, and I remember when I was a young guy interviewing for McKinsey, and a Norwegian partner asked me, like, what if Norway runs out of oil, and what should be the national strategy? And I said, well, you could still try to transition and be some kind of a expert in energy. And I think that's actually now what's happening when you kind of start from a fossil fuels, and you can still keep doing energy, but in the renewable way. So you can kind of stack things together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And this kind of better and use of the energy infrastructure and land, I guess, is a theme. So you can combine these production forms, so solar and wind, and also this photovoltaic agriculture.
Indeed. I mean, in Alberta at the moment, Cortica is mainly solar, but we do see a lot of sort of co-located projects, and there's definitely some developers that have this portfolio there. Agri-PV is something that's on its way into Alberta. And, you know, we've seen with Alberta sort of positioning itself as kind of the leader in the energy transition, we've seen a tremendous amount of demand for renewable energy projects being developed and then going to market, naturally so. And one of the side effects of that is that the government has realized that they need to put a bit more structure around that business to ensure that it's growing in a, I would say, responsible way. And so we've just come through a fairly significant market reform in Alberta. And one of the outputs of that has been sort of identifying the classification of the land and what it can be used for, and in protecting sort of really high value agriculture land. And alongside of that, then, is the government now looking towards agri-PV to support the benefits that they know that solar energy will bring to the province. So it's early days in Alberta. I think we see, and maybe James can speak more to agri-PV in Europe, but you know, we definitely see Europe leading the way, but we're starting to see the indicators in Alberta that are pushing in that direction. So I would guess it's going to be a fairly fast journey to get there.
Yeah, James, if you look with take your structuring hat on, and then you say, well, you have a already complex future project with the future cash flows being uncertain and lots of scenarios. And then somebody says, well, let's stack like a two or three production forms together. How does it look from a structuring point of view?
Yeah, a very interesting question, and definitely a trend we're seeing in the market now of co-locating different assets together. The main reason for this is to produce the energy output that matches the demand. So to get a base load, obviously, renewable energy is excellent in terms of affordability, clean, and it's local. But it is variable, you know. And so in order to balance the production profiles of solar and wind farms, putting them together makes a lot of sense. So we at Corkia are doing co-located wind and solar projects here in Finland. Actually works very, very well. The correlation between wind and solar kind of naturally works very well. And then the other key element is the battery energy storage. So such that you can store the excess electricity that's being generated in periods of high wind or high solar. So those peak periods during the day of solar, you can store that electricity and then load shift it, to use a technical term, into the evening when you need the power production the most. So now, you know, what this means for, you know, the value of these projects, yes, it makes things more complicated, but it does make things more stable as well. So it also means, you know, it's good news for, you know, your cash flow forecasting in terms of predicting, you know, more stable cash flows, and so good for leverage. So actually what we see is combining these different technologies on a blended basis is very helpful for, you know, for the financing and things, but certainly does make the projects more complicated. Storage in particular is very complicated when you start mixing import and export. But yeah, lots of good structuring to do around.
Yeah, I guess you could do kind of optionality. So you start with a strong project. Let's say it's a wind. So you model the wind, and then you build options. Hey, let's do solar on top of that, and let's do energy back here, and let's sort of that's optional. Because I guess that's what Korkea does. You kind of structure very good project cases, but you don't actually put the iron on the ground yourself, or you don't do the construction phase. So you to put a lot of intellectual power in developing the good cash flow beneficial business case.
Yeah, so Korkea, you know, made the decision a few years ago to focus the majority of our investments in the development phase of renewable energy. Yeah, that's because we think that offers a very attractive risk return profile for, you know, for the company and for our investors. So the development phase means, you know, everything from the very early stages of, you know, an idea or, you know, prospecting of a project through the greenfield development all the way until the project is ready to build. So that means ready to put iron in the ground, you know, put your spade in the ground. And so to do that, you need a lot of work on the ground, in particular around land. We've talked a little bit about land use and getting the necessary permits you need to, you know, to transition away from the land. A grid connection, obviously very important, and then the permitting. So whatever environmental and other permits you need for the site. But then, of course, also you need to commercialize the proposition. And so, you know, that means putting together the business case for these sites. Sometimes that's very easy because it's a very established market with a energy market, other, you know, maybe with a feed-in tariff, you know, or some sort of government subsidy. But, you know, more often than not now, increasing relevance for PPAs or other offtake mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're focused on that early stage development and getting those projects to ready to build. And then, you know, to take these projects through construction requires a lot larger, you know, sums of capital.
Yeah, and I guess it's a better and use of the land. And but inherently, aren't the structures quite inert? So if you put solar or wind, it's of course might look a bit ugly from the sort of aesthetic point of view, but from the ecological point of view, they are pretty solid builds.
Indeed. And I think, like, if we take Alberta, for example, where historically the land has been used for oil or gas wells, it's a much more invasive process, right? And significantly more work to remove that. Whereas if we want to decommission a solar park in 40 years' time, you know, it's a much lighter process, right? You don't have to disturb the land nearly as much, et cetera. So, and also keeping in mind that how you disturb the land when you build is also sometimes regulated. So I think, you know, I think that both governments and landowners have sort of learned along the ways. And I think as responsible developers, it's something that we're very mindful of, so that when we turn the shovel over to the next person, that we've done our responsible duty for that.
Yeah. And James, perhaps we need to touch a little bit on the UK. To me, it's an island, so offshore wind comes to mind. Is that stereotype or the truth?
No, that's certainly, I mean, that's certainly the truth. I mean, the UK is a great case study, similar, you know, in a different way to Alberta, as a great case study for the energy transition. The UK's got very ambitious targets in terms of reaching net zero, aiming for a decarbonized power system by 2035. You know, that's the step that's been set in order to meet the 2050 targets. And so I would say an early adopter of renewable energy, obviously blessed with a wealth of offshore wind resource, which, you know, has been a huge growth area. And, your North Sea has been a leader in that. Also now been, you know, had a lot of onshore solar and has been a market leader for batteries. So I think, yeah, very interesting, you know, market. Obviously, when it comes to land use, a very different profile to Alberta or even Finland in terms of the amount of available land onshore. And there's been a lot of discussion over the last couple of years around land use in regards to food security. So using agricultural farming land for solar. And kind of regulations are working through that in terms of working out what grade of land we should be able to do solar on and not. The other big discussion point is where solar farms are planned around conurbations, which is obviously makes a lot of sense for putting the generation near to the demand, which is a big part of the energy transition. You know, when we relied on fossil fuels, we had large, you know, coal plants, you know, situated in certain areas, and that electricity, you know, that power being transported across the country. Now we're looking at smaller intermittent generation closer to the demand centers, but those demand centers heavily populated, and you know, the areas of green spaces are heavily protected. In the UK we have a green belts and areas of outstanding natural beauty, and so trying to navigate finding the right spots for the solar farms and the batteries with these land classifications is a real challenge. But thankfully, with great people on the ground, we're managing to find the sites that make sense, that are unintrusive visually, from a visual impact perspective, and strategically located for what the demand and the grid situation requires.
Yeah, and Kristin, if then you look from the environmental hat point of view, this, so somebody builds a great Excel, how do you add the kind of a environmental layer on the project, or what's important there?
It's a very good question, and I think we're constantly trying to find ways to do better and be better at that. But I think it's quite a tiered approach. So first off, I would say that renewable energy is inherently green. Mm-hmm. And so we're
dark green even.
it can even be dark green indeed. And I think, to start our sustainable journey already on a green foot, I think is a big win for Cordica and for the environment and for our investors. But I think we should also be very mindful that the development process, so the permitting that James mentioned specifically, is usually very regulated. And this means that the local governments, the local authorities, are dictating sort of the protections that need to be in place, even though we're doing green business, right? So we're doing green, and then the local authorities are asking us to make sure we're protecting biodiversity and wildlife and, these kind of more granular approaches to that. And then I think we're also being mindful of the communities that we're in, how the energy is going to be used, how it benefits folks kind of from a social perspective as well. So we try and look at the work that we do from multiple perspectives. And I think the big win for us is that, doing good things for the environment and making good returns is sort of just inherently part of our business. And so it's just a matter then of refining to make sure that we're maximizing the green work that we're doing.
What's this agriculture, photovoltaic agri PV? And I guess you have a kind of a new country in your portfolio, Italy. Could you, James, talk about a little about that?
Yeah, sure. So agri-PV or agricultural photovoltaic is the combination of solar panels and farming, to put it simply. And so this is part of a general trend to try and integrate the energy supply with the existing use of the land, and make the best use of the land, for everything that we need. So both farming, for food and also the renewable energy generation. And so we're really pleased to have started last year. We entered the Italian market, which I would say is a leader for agri-PV. And, we're starting developing our first agri-PV projects there with our local development partners. It's an emerging sector. Agri-PV means different things in different countries, depending on how you do the design and what the local constraints are. But it's very exciting. We're really, pleased to see this sort of innovation in the solar sector, and is exactly the type of thing that we want to be doing at Cordica.
Yeah, I had last summer I was with my family in Capri. So Kristina, now that you have this country portfolio, what kind of things you look when you enter new market like Italy, for example?
Well, it's a good question, and we have, I would say, quite a structured process for how we're looking at new markets. I would say first that the way that Cortica has built its business and the breadth that we have allows us also sort of to pick the signals that are happening either regionally or sort of in the countries that we're in, like Canada, for example. It's a big country. We're in one province. So we, because of our existing footprint, we have sort of eyes on multiple areas anyway. So when we combine that with our structured process, and our structured process is that we kind of target the kind of countries that we'd like to be in. We assess the renewable energy industry maturity, you know, where are they in their renewable life cycle process? What capabilities do we have as a team that we can add there? We start also searching for these top tier developers that James was mentioning for. So it's a very robust process. And we also then think about how that particular country might fit in with our existing portfolio, either from a technology perspective or a capability perspective. You know, what resources do we need to look after that country? So it's a fairly robust process with which we tap into the expertise that we have, either across the country managers or other resources in Cortica. And then we're looking sort of really deep dive locally, you know, start with a desktop study. And then we go into like tapping into local consultants to validate what we think we see that's happening in that market. And then, you know, at some point in that process, we meet these local development teams, and hopefully then the process comes towards a new opportunity for us.
And I guess if it's a big country like a, let's say USA, you could even make a state by state decision. Yes. So region by region.
Indeed, in a country like US, it's almost like every state is a country when you're looking at from a market entry perspective, right? I mean, it requires its own detailed analysis if that were to be the case.
Excellent. Yeah, and you said you have 9 countries, so I guess you can kind of compare at least those 9 countries in a kind of matrix and like a offshore solar, wind, height of the towers, suitability for agri PV. But is that kind of a matrix you build between the countries, or sort of a competencies of countries, or what are the benefits of working in an international organization?
Yeah, so I think that's definitely fundamental to our business model at Cortica, is that we want to be diversified both globally and then across multiple projects in all of our countries. And we really do, over the last 3 years, we've ramped up our portfolio and consistently entered new markets. And even though every country is very different, obviously the energy transition is a global phenomenon, a global opportunity, a global problem to solve. But it's also a very local problem that needs to be solved locally. And every country is very different in its energy transition, where it's coming from and where it wants to get to. But I think it does amaze us, or, you know, we're pleased to see how much consistency and learnings we can get from different markets and apply them across our portfolio globally. And I think that's because countries are at different phases of their journey. We have some countries we're invested in who are on their, you know, second wave, if you like, of renewable energy. So they had a subsidized wave 5-10 years ago with government subsidies, incentivizing the first solar and wind farms. And now then there was a period of, you know, slowdown when the economics didn't make sense. And now we have a kind of second wave. We have other countries, you know, like Spain was a market we've been in for a while. That's obviously very advanced and, you know, is often, you know, the leader for how things are going to go in the future. And we have other countries who are, you know, who are really at the beginning of their renewable energy journey. And so you can kind of see this cyclical cycle across different countries. And then, of course, we have the topical issues that affect all of the countries. So, you know, geopolitics, cost of living crises, you know, macro things like cost of money. These obviously affect all of, you know, the portfolios and countries.
Yeah, Christina, I mean, I had the CEO of Gasgrid here, which is the Finnish. We have a very good energy grid, Fingrid, very strong and stable. In the first Korge episode, we compared favorably to the German one, which is a bit shabby. But is the green hydrogen, do you think it's a thing? Is that the two-directional electricity grid? Is it that those kind of emerging trends on your table?
I would maybe divert to James on this, because it's not at least in the work that I'm working on.
So, green hydrogen is definitely a thing. It's a very big thing. And it's something that we're tracking really closely. It's an emerging technology. It's one that lots of governments and, consultants are, betting on being the key way to decarbonize some really hard to decarbonize sectors, and also to solve this kind of long duration storage issue that, maybe we have if you look on the kind of longer term, bigger picture energy transition. So yeah, super exciting technology, some really exciting things happening, some great pilot projects, producing small green hydrogen, for some of the smaller uses. Quite a lot longer way to go before we can really, we'll really see this really changing the game for the energy use of, big transport. And a big opportunity, and certainly really from our perspective, when we're thinking about green hydrogen, we're obviously thinking at it from an energy standpoint. Green hydrogen requires very cheap energy to run the electrolyzer, and the economics to make green hydrogen competitive with alternatives relies on very cheap energy. And so, it's natural that we see these, green hydrogen hubs being set up where there will be a, where we can have a very cheap source of renewable energy. And so that's why it's very relevant for Finland as a country with, with great wind resources in particular, and lots of land and good transport links for, in particular, for, if we think about ammonia, transporting that via the ports. Obviously, lots happening in the Mediterranean as well, with super high radiation yields, and again, good transport links to connect to different places. From a Corkia's perspective, it's a technology we're very much tracking. It's certainly very relevant for lots of our sites, but a little bit early for us to invest heavily in the development phase yet. But we hope that's that's coming, and certainly keen to continue to track the market.
Yeah, definitely, it's in kind of a EU interest, where we have a big of a big natural gas infrastructure which needs to be replaced, and the one way to use it, it would be to use the network with the green hydrogen, but it's a cost issue. I mean, I guess in simple terms, it's cheaper to run the excess energy to lithium iron batteries than to convert it to hydrogen with the great loss. At least with the current technology.
At the moment, yeah. So, but look, let's not, we've been looking at some graphs of, the price of solar panels, right, over the last decade, and how those have come down and technology improved. So I think, we can be optimistic about the improvements in the efficiencies of that technology. And in the meantime, there's, it's the transition to get there, and paving the way for that. So I think the interesting thing for me on green hydrogen is it going to be, really large green hydrogen productions, or are we going to see much more smaller localized electrolyzers very close to demand? Those are two quite different business models and markets. And, I think we see people trying to target those two places, separately.
Yeah, Christina, I teased you a little bit about the shades of green, so that's a thing, I guess, a regular green and dark green, and you get this distinction that your font structure is rated dark green. What does that mean? And
so dark green means that we have been able to achieve sort of the darkest green rating by an external party. So S&P came in and audited Corkia and the way that we invest and the way that we operate our business, and said that we, have met the standards, their standards, their third-party standards, that our funding can be dark green. And this means that for Corkia, we have more funding opportunities to do more projects, but also to do more good. Mm. And so it's really an additional asset that we have at our disposal to make sure that we're deploying green money into our green assets.
Is that the separate thing from this SFDR 6, 8, and 9 or some similar?
Well, it's similar.
Yeah.
So the SFDR is more on the, it's maybe just a different mechanism and used in a different funding pocket.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess to some extent, being rated 9 has also disadvantages. So it's some investors prefer the classification 8. But you're basically running a kind of, I guess, feeder fund is too small way to describe your business. You're building a very important energy future portfolios, which will turn into quite a massive amount of generation capacity. I guess some of the project will not be implemented, but if you do a good job, you will get the implementing operator who will buy the project from you. But could you maybe a little bit describe the journey of sort of developing the project and then exiting it? Is it, which one is the, I guess there are different set of skills.
And that's and I think you're right, you know, you describe about what we're doing. I think I mentioned that we've decided to focus on the development phase, and that's really because that's where we think the capital that we have, which in the grand scheme of, renewable energy or green investors,
you build the founding stone.
We're modestly sized, to put it to speak, but with that, relatively small amount of capital, we're investing in the development stage gives you the most kind of bang for your buck in terms of impact. And so, we have been able to build a very large portfolio, and yes, not all of our assets, might make it all the way through. That's why we have a diversified portfolio. Equally, the portfolio is growing all the time, both organically and us entering more markets. And so the size, size really, really matters there. And then when it comes to the development phase and then, refinancing or, taking that project forward, it is very different. The first step for us as we enter a new market is to, understand that market from an energy fundamentals, a lot of the things we were talking about there, understand exactly where the market's at in its renewable energy journey and its phase. And then it's about finding the right local partner. And that's something we take very seriously, and we've got a lot of experience in. And really, what we look for is a local developer. We believe that development is fundamentally a local business. You need people who are on the ground, have strong relationships with the local stakeholders, whether or not that be landowners or policymakers or the local councils making the planning decisions. So we find, we look to find a really top local team with a track record in developing renewable energy assets, or if it's the first time renewable energy is happening in a country, maybe they've done, a lot of them have done real estate development in the past or other sorts of development. These developers are typically very entrepreneurial characters because development is a very entrepreneurial business. So that's really the first step for us is, and we do partnerships with these local developers. So that's a very specific type of transaction. Specific type of negotiation, Sammy. And very different by the time that we have a project that's, been fully developed, is at ready to build stage. At that point, we have a commodity, which, albeit it's a private infrastructure asset, it's still at that point very well understood. There's a wide range of investor universe of people looking for those assets, whether or not that be strategic buyers, so local utility energy companies, or big financial institutions, funds who are looking to acquire these assets.
But it's a real thing. I mean, a bit of a personal reflection. When I was living in London, I was supposed to come to Finland, and I bought a piece of land in Suvisaaristo, and then I designed a massive house there, and I applied for a permit for it, and then sadly I got divorced. But during that time, when I had done that work, the piece of land increased in value from 220,000 euros to 330,000, mostly because I had done the building and permitting work. So it's a kind of similar thing. So it has real value when somebody goes through the trouble of building all the building blocks and saying, here is a nice piece of project, just build it. And that's real value.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that sort of permitting development work, it's often, you know, there's a science to it, but there's also an art to it. And relationships are very important. That's why, you know, we're so focused on our, you know, relationships as well.
And I guess you could get lucky or smart. You do such a good project that somebody says, hey, this is good quality, I'll take this. Hey, this works, let's take more of this. So you could that could be actually a way to do it.
Yeah, you know, very often when we, you know, very often when we come to, you know, market, you know, sell our assets, then of course investors are looking for a portfolio of assets, you know, an exclusivity over acquiring other assets in your portfolio, and you know that becomes part of the, you know, the transaction at that point. And also, even, you know, for us, if we think increasingly as well, there may be opportunities to take projects beyond that permitting stage and start to do some more of the, you know, the later dated work. And if that makes sense, then we're certainly, you know, keen to do that and continue the journey with the local developer as well.
Yeah. Is there sort of the, I guess the environment has got very positive to green energy and this project in particular, but then the infrastructure funds have suddenly seen a delta of interest rates going from 0% to 4%. I guess that's kind of a spanner in the works, but I guess it can be mitigated with the market. I guess just moves to a new equilibrium, and that's it. Is it the kind of a thing in the market which is moving projects to new directions?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, the right, you know, interest rate hike has definitely caused a change in valuations for energy assets. I guess one interesting thing was it took a while for that to feed through. So we had a bit of a peak for renewable energy assets a year and a half ago with energy, you know, very high energy prices from the war, and you know, interest rates still very low, inflation high. So that really was a peak in valuations. And then last year we've had a little bit of a normalization. You know, I would say, yeah, back to a new equilibrium, as you said, with, you know, with higher interest rates. So there's no question renewable energy assets are 40, 50 year, you know, contract, you know, long dated cash flows, you know, so with a very high exposure to interest rates. But there are some mitigating factors that kind of have caused the valuations to, you know, reach an equilibrium. So some of those would be the cost of construction of these assets, so the capex, so solar panel prices coming down, and you know, very interesting topic at the moment with the geopolitics with the US and China, and if you look at, you know, over time, that's, you know, that's come down considerably. So it's definitely some efficiencies on the capex side. Energy prices are still, you know, higher than, you know, expected in the past, and long-term forecasts, you know, still very firm. Inflation is still, you know, pretty high across the board, so that obviously increases the expected future energy prices as well. And then still, there's a huge amount of demand for these assets, right? I mean, even though there's lots of development happening, we're still a long way behind, you know, our targets for renewable energy deployment. And, you know, there's increasingly, it looks like our estimations on electricity demand are only going one way, given increased digitalization. You know, if AI really takes off, then that's going to increase hugely as well the compute power we need. And so, you know, we're very bullish on the amount of electricity needed, and therefore the amount of renewable energy needed. And that really will underpin the valuations going forwards.
Christina, do you think there's a bit of a global game on the regulation? I mean, we have the Inflation Reduction Act investments in the USA. We have a Fit for 50 EU. Green Deal kind of structures, and is the kind of the government or intergovernmental layer in the play here?
I would say so, and I think that the US has done an amazing job for the US in setting the tone, right? And I think that the EU is sort of chasing a bit, you know, the US has considerable competitive advantage because of the Inflation Reduction Act and some of the other policies or areas that were enacted over maybe the last 4 years. And I think the EU has considerable gap to fill to make sure that we have, were able to stay competitive. So I would say that, you know, that gap, not the gap, that layer exists. And I think that we're seeing some of the benefits because we're seeing a lot more, for example, solar panels being manufactured in the US, which is also helping to reduce costs and you know, these kind of things. So there are benefits, but I think that the majority of the benefits right now from the IRA are the Inflation Reduction Act are happening in the US, and we're maybe not seeing the same pace across the EU with the regulations that the EU has enacted.
Yeah, I guess that could be an opportunity for your North American assets in a way, because you can balance Dovas that way if it stays that way. But I guess the China issue is, I mean, they really been drying down the solar panel price, and I guess it's interesting that now the traditional Western world is taking the challenge on the production front as well.
Indeed, and we're seeing, I mean, in Canada as well, we're seeing the government put investment towards driving local manufacturing, either in component parts, even in mining, for example, doing responsible mining to supply the critical minerals needed for them. So I think we're starting to see governments recognize that, you know, transformational change requires more than just, you know, light policies, that they really need to start enacting structures and monies to allow private sector to compete with China. And so I as a Canadian, well, I'm also Finn, but as a Canadian, I'm really hopeful that our government is taking real steps. You know, we have our own version of the Inflation Reduction Act. We're now really pushing on the critical mining. You know, mining is a big thing in Canada, but doing responsible mining and how do we kind of tie the strings between being respectful of the environment, you know, being good competitive players and trying to drive real transformational change. So I think it's a real balancing act, and for most governments, especially ones that have, you know, maybe 4-year cycles, it's really hard to have real big change when you have policy that's moving maybe every 4 years. And I think the EU has been suffering a little bit from that.
Yeah, I have to ask. I have voted once Boris Johnson for the mayor of London. So
So
I had to, for some crazy reason as a Finn, I
Many
had the
did.
Right to vote. There was this Red Ken was the alternative, so I think Boris was my choice. But I have to ask. I mean, we have elections coming and Labour kind of coming in. But is the energy topic at all in the UK politics?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think everywhere, and it's amazing to see how energy has become such a political topic, and it really is, you know, part of the, you know, battle lines that are being drawn, you know, for elections. We have a massive year of elections this year globally. I think I forget the stat, but something like 50% of the population has a election this year, and energy's, you know, energy, climate change, you know, whatever it is definitely on the agenda. In the UK in particular, it's definitely a key part of the difference between the Labour and the Conservative parties, both sides trying to draw, you know, gain votes on this topic. And it's good to see, to be honest, because we actually just completed a study with Imperial University on, you know, what the challenges are for meeting the UK's targets to decarbonize the power system by 2035. And two of the big kind of red areas there were financing and investment and public support. So both of these really need to be driven by government and by policy. And so financing and support comes back to the IRA and, you know, doing something like that, which can really drive investment into the sector, because even though there's a lot of money and there's, you know, the UK is a great place to source capital for these sorts of projects, still we need a lot more than there already. And the other issue is public support, and the energy transition is a huge transition. And it's going to affect everyone in their everyday lives. And it is a costly transition. And the next kind of 10, 20 years are when the costs are going to come. And then the benefits are maybe a little bit longer in the future for, you know, the next generation and the, you know, the planet more generally. And maybe we haven't quite explained that fully to the electorate and to everyone. And so I think there's certainly a lot of people lobbying for more transparency on exactly what this means for everyone. And of course, the political parties positioning themselves slightly differently. So concretely, Labour have more ambitious decarbonisation targets than the Conservative Party. So I guess many in our industry are kind of, you know, looking forward maybe to a bit more of a, you know, a bit more of an accelerated strategy in regards to the energy transition.
Yeah, and then what about, I mean, this last year was a bit of a transition year. Like you said, there was this energy crisis, war, and then zero interest rate, then lots of inflation, and energy prices have a little bit going down, and the projects moving up and down. And then now we're in the maybe normalizing phase. But I guess to me, I guess I'm a little bit optimist, but it looks kind of the fog will clear out and we are moving to the more normal cycle. What's your feel of the market at the moment?
I think you've described it pretty well there, actually. I think it's fair to say we're in a period of normalization right now. I'd say there is quite a lot of uncertainty across the board because there's so much change. So in almost all of the markets we're working in, Alberta's a great example, UK's a great example. There's policy change, there's regulatory change happening, you know, almost every week, the news flow. So uncertainty is never good for, you know, for investment and for, you know, for finance. But in the medium term, we are also, you know, personally, you know, very optimistic on the sector itself. Ultimately, we just need to do more quicker, and that's what, you know, that's what we're trying to do. But I think the dust is settling. I think second half of the year, certainly things are gonna be very normalized, and hopefully, yeah, looking forward to that.
Excellent. Well, I've had Christina Sweet and James Spooner from Korkia, and I think we'll move to the bonus episode. I don't know if you're up to this, but could we a little bit discuss what do you bloody foreigners think of Finns? I think this could be our inside episode. Don't worry, it's a very limited group of hardcore fans which subscribe to that.
Okay.
So let's join the inside episode. Ja he, jotka haluaa muuten kuunnella tämän tai katsoa tämän, niin mä laitan tekstityksen tuohon videoversioon suomeksi, että tätä löytyy sieltä videosta sitten. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.